Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, May 13th. I'm Shane Dawson alongside Ruby Walsh, and you are listening to Game On.
And coming up between now and the new music show at 7 p.m, Mark Langdon chats European football. Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson dial in from North Carolina ahead of the US PGA Championship at Quail Hollow. Nigel Dunn reflects on the opening round of the Tall Shane Cup, and Niall Moran has his say on the latest provincial hurling action.
Plus, we'll round up today's sports news headlines. So if you want to have your say, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 0871879200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, Ruby.
How are you, Shane?
I'm very well. How's the form?
Absolutely flying.
Reflecting
How
still.
How couldn't you be in this weather?
Exactly, exactly. It is absolutely stunning out, and we are stuck here in a dark and dreary studio to provide the nation with an hour of sport. Sure, why wouldn't we be? Exciting times for any listeners who are fans of American football, because that is headline news today in our news headlines, Ruby, I think. Because the Irish government are pledging €10 million to secure the right to host a regular season NFL game in Ireland this year. Today, we have confirmation of the lineup as the Pittsburgh Steelers will play the Minnesota Vikings at Croke Park on September 28 next, with kickoff at 2:30 in the afternoon. Henry Hodgson is general manager of the NFL in the UK and Ireland, and he's been telling our own Joe Stack that the funding is a vital preconditional requirement on their part.
It's a condition of us going to any market. You know, that's how we work with local government and local stakeholders. But it obviously isn't the only money that's going to this. We, as the NFL, and then the clubs that are involved, put a significant investment into these games too. And so combined, we want to make sure that we put on the best possible event for the fans that come into the market.
Why would €10 million, one way or the other, make a difference?
I think it shows the commitment that the city that we're talking to is making to these games, and therefore we'll make the commitment back again.
We're expecting 72,000, hopefully, from your point of view, a sellout. Talk to me about ticket prices.
We're going to inform people who've signed up to our Registry of Interest when tickets will go on sale. At that point, we'll then show them what the ticket prices are. We want to make sure that there's an entry-level opportunity for new people, perhaps people who haven't experienced an NFL game before, to come here. They'll range from about €85 all the way up to you know, for the top tickets, obviously for hospitality, around €200.
So one of the largest international sporting events to ever take place in Ireland, with extensive tourism boost expected.
As you think about it, 72,000 people, I don't know how many will come in to watch the game. Mm. Would you be expecting 50,000?
I'd say so. It's going to be huge.
Like,
I mean, you think of what the Aer Lingus College Football Classic Series brings in, and that's had a considerable financial benefit in recent years, and isn't it Kansas State facing Iowa State this August, so that's a month before a regular season NFL game. Like, I mean, the numbers that college football brings. Now, I know college football in general over there attracts crazy numbers, and
yeah, but I often am coming home from York when that game is on, and you land in York, Manchester, Ryanair, and to see the amount of private jets parked in Dublin Airport. Mm. For that college game is off the charts. Now, people will say, like, that's environmental or whatever else, but from an economic point of view, and I doubt you nor I, Shane Dawson, are qualified economists, but the trickle-down economics here for Dublin, I could see why the government is spending $10 million, because I have a funny feeling they're going to recoup a hell of a lot more.
Yeah. That $10 million does seem a lot, and then your mind automatically goes, oh, could we be investing it in League of Ireland academies or in a velodrome or in the Sport Ireland campus? But as you say, the
this
rewards
is not an investment in sport. This is $10 million to try and make 25.
Yeah, and it will. No, and it will. And it will easily do that. You talk about private jets lining up for college football. I'd say the numbers will be doubled or tripled.
Just to make what you get out of Dublin Airport, what you get out of hotels, what the spend in the city will be, etc. I just think it'll be, I think it's money well spent. I just hope to spend whatever profit they get.
Wisely. Yeah, very much so. Mark Langdon is on the line to chat European football. Mark, will you be coming over for the American football?
I think I'd rather come over and watch GAA, really, rather than NFL. We've had NFL in London for a number of years now, and I mean, it is a mega roadshow, whether it's at Wembley or Tottenham. You know, the footfall is incredible. London does change. You know, there's a lot of people that come in from the US for the games, as well as from all over Europe, because, you know, countries like Germany, it's huge as well. So, you know, if you're a fan of NFL, I'd say from anywhere in Europe, you kind of just head to those games. So I think it would be a great experience. I wouldn't be the biggest NFL fan and struggle to get excited when it's in London, never mind flying over to Dublin.
So Ancelotti is gone from Madrid, or going from Madrid, heading off to take over Brazil. Hardly the biggest surprise in the world, is it?
No. This feels like it's been sort of about 5 or 6 years in the making, really. Ancelotti has been linked with this Brazil job for a long, long time. I think he's probably at the right age now to take you know, an international challenge, because a lot of club managers don't like the fact that, you know, when you're working at international football, you just don't get that connection. You're not working with the players often enough. And, you know, you're waiting for such long periods to get games that actually matter. But with a World Cup coming sort of this time next year in the US, you know, it's an amazing opportunity for Ancelotti to take charge of, you know, one of the super nations that they're struggling a bit at the moment. But he's got a fantastic connection with star player Vinicius from their time together at Real Madrid. So really interested to see how Ancelotti gets on. I think international football should suit him, really. He's not kind of one of these great deep thinkers about the game. He's somebody that just sort of gets the 11 players, works out sort of, you know, how can I make a team out of this? And he makes the players feel comfortable and then allows them to kind of, you know, go out and deliver. You know, you get some managers that really micro manage the situation. You think of somebody like Pep Guardiola that would do that. Ancelotti's the complete opposite of that. And so I think international football will do him well. And then Xabi Alonso coming in to replace him at Real Madrid, it was probably time for a change. This season hasn't gone how they would have hoped at Real Madrid, particularly after they lost to Barcelona at the weekend, which means no title. They've lost the Spanish Cup final to Barcelona already, went out of the Champions League to Arsenal. So probably feels like the right move all round for everybody. And I think for Xabi Alonso, you know, this time last year he was being linked with the Liverpool job, wasn't he? And sort of turned that down, stayed at Leverkusen another year. Now he gets the Real Madrid opportunity. It's a big job, but one that he will kind of feel like he was born to do, I think.
I do want to talk about the 7-goal thriller in El Clasico. Before we talk about the match action, though, what's the latest on Trent? Is he going to be at Real for the Club World Cup?
Well, Real Madrid are certainly hoping so, and they're also hoping that Xabi Alonso is in as well. There's been some discussion there that maybe he wouldn't, but they're hopeful that he will now sort of be in for the Club World Cup. It's an awkward sort of time, really, because contracts in sort of football run until kind of, you know, June, and it's... this tournament is new, and I don't think anybody really thought it through in terms of, well, what happens in a Trent Alexander-Arnold situation, or a manager sort of leaving in Ancelotti and being replaced by Alonso at the end of the season. But I think if Real Madrid can get it sort of done, and they will have to probably pay some kind of fee for him, then they should do, because they've got no right backs really worthy of the name at the moment. Danny Carvajal, who won the Euros with Spain, he's been out for a long time. And I know you said they were going to speak about the 7-goal thriller. Lucas Vazquez, who's playing at right back at the moment, certainly didn't cover himself in glory in that game. And there's, I think it's about £100 million to the winner of the Club World Cup. So I think it would be a decent investment if they have to spend, I don't know, a tenth of that to get Trent in on time. But I mean, maybe he wants a sort of a break and a holiday, and sort of trying to, you know, get himself sorted in Madrid for the start of the season. So I'm not sure if anybody's even asked sort of Trent Alexander-Arnold what he wants to do in terms of playing at the Club World Cup.
So Barcelona 4, Real Madrid 3. They're not mathematically out of the title race, but realistically they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. This was one of the games of the season. I do feel like we've said that quite a lot with Barcelona because of the way that they play. They just lend itself to these fantastic games. They found themselves 2-0 down inside sort of the opening 15 minutes. There was a lot of space in behind, like it's been left all season, really. They're so aggressive in the way that they play. And Kylian Mbappe took advantage with a couple of goals. But, you know, by half-time, Barcelona had turned the match around. Lamine Yamal, the teenage sensation, Lamine Machine was how one of the commentators described him. He scored just another wonderful goal, called it in with his left foot. Rafinha was on target as well. And Barcelona, a couple of good goals in there. They also, there was some, you know, Lucas Vazquez made an horrendous mistake for one of them, just dallied on the ball and got caught. Also, Kylian Mbappe, he scored a hat-trick in the game overall, despite being on the losing side. But he was really lazy in possession. It was robbed off him, and Barcelona managed to score a goal that way as well. So I think it really showed the strengths and weaknesses of both teams. So Barcelona going forward are fantastic, but you know, they just give you opportunities and they concede goals, and you know, it's a quite chaotic way of playing. And for Real Madrid, fantastic when they've got the ball, but they just show a lack of interest when they haven't got it. And I'm not sure that that's a way a successful team can be run. And, you know, Xabi Alonso's got some difficult and tricky decisions to make, really, because that relationship between Vinicius and Kylian Mbappe, I would say, is not perfect at the moment. The Spanish press are certainly making a big deal out of the friction between the pair and the fact that Mbappe wasn't mad on some of the sort of lack of service he was getting from Vinicius, not only at the weekend but for the last few months, seen as sort of, you know, these two sort of superstars both want the ball all the time. And yeah, that happened with Mbappe previously, didn't it, with Paris Saint-Germain, and funnily enough it looks like they've become a better team for getting rid of him.
They do. It's kind of ironic that they could go to win the Champions League as soon as he's gone. Well, they definitely have a chance of it. In the Serie A, Inter Milan, after a lot of rain, eventually got to beat Torino, and Napoli dropped points against Genoa.
They did, Jen. Napoli could afford to draw one game in the run-in, and they did. A 2-2 home match against Genoa. You know, I think they would have been expecting to win that game, but they didn't. And Inter have sort of turned the screw now, and will sort of make sure that there's no more mistakes from Napoli in terms of, you know, if they want to win the league. But you're right, Ruby, about that. I mean, this was played in the most atrocious conditions at times, but I think Inter, they're kind of made for it. You know, they've reached the Champions League not by being as good on the ball, say, as Barcelona, but they're just so tough and, you know, can kind of just get the job done in any kind of circumstances. There was a delay in the first half as well. There was a medical emergency. And in the second half, there were sort of bits of the game that really, I'm not sure it would have gone ahead in some other countries, but in Italy, they do like to sort of just to carry on, really, in the rain. I think in the Premier League it might well have been called off, but it was an absolutely torrential downpour. But a 2-0 win for Inter, so they're going to look to close out the season, and now there can be no more mistakes from Napoli in the final couple of matches.
When you look at those couple of matches, so Inter play Lazio, who are fifth, and they're away to Como in the final day, who are 10th, and Napoli away to Parma and at home to Cagliari. On paper, you would say Napoli fixtures are easier. However, those two sides are still looking to avoid the drop, because I think there's about, off the top of my head, six or seven teams even that could get technically relegated to Serie B as well. So they're not givens.
No, they're not gimmies. And you're right to say that Lazio game is more sort of difficult. That's the sort of stumbling block, I think, for Inter. But now that they're clear of kind of these midweek games, I would still expect them to beat Lazio. And it's really about whether Napoli can hold their nerve, because they know how big an opportunity this is. I don't think they were expecting to be in this position at the start of the season, particularly in January when Kvaratskhelia left to go to Paris Saint-Germain. And so it's just whether they can handle everything that comes with it. And it's a very emotional club, Napoli, you know, one that where the fans can... I think that they're kind of their biggest strength and sometimes their biggest weakness with the kind of way that they support the team just lends itself to, I think, putting pressure on them as much as anything else. Like, you have these great big, you know, thousands of fans waiting for them at the airport after big away games when they've won them. And, you know, the atmosphere, you know, against Cagliari on the final day will be just incredible. But you've got to be able to deal with it. And they'll take, they'll take thousands to Parma, and you know, even if they can't get inside the stadium, they'll just want to be in the city. And I would expect Napoli to do it, but you would have said last week they would have beaten Genoa, and they didn't. So you know, you get funny results, don't you, this time of the season when the pressure's really on.
Yeah, an interesting run in for Europe as well. We're all talking about the chase for Champions League football in England. What we do know, Atalanta mathematically guaranteed Champions League football after beating Roma 2-1, unfortunately ending Roma's 19 match unbeaten run in Serie A. We are going to talk about the Bundesliga very shortly, but it's an interesting race for the top four, top five in Italy as well.
Yeah, so Italy's top four for Champions League, and unlike if the league is level on points or the relegation spots, it goes on head to head in Italy. So at the moment, it's really difficult to know because it's quite tight between, I think, Lazio. I've got the league table in front of me, but it's sort of Lazio are definitely there. Juventus, so Bologna.
Atalanta third, Juventus fourth. Atalanta are guaranteed Champions League football, obviously, as are Napoli, Inter. Juve in fourth, Lazio fifth, Roma sixth, Bologna seventh, and Milan. And there's only, what, 4 points separating basically fourth and eighth. Even Fiorentina, 59 points in ninth.
Yeah, I mean, so it is really tight. You know, I think sort of, you know, Juventus have just been sort of grinding out in recent weeks. They spent an absolute fortune in the summer. They haven't got it right at all. You think of like Huijsen, the centre back that they let go to Bournemouth. I mean, that's looking like a sort of, you know, a terrible mistake, given he's now one of the most wanted players in Europe. They sacked their manager. And tried to just get sort of, you know, Igor Tudor came to the club to just try to get them over the line. I think Roma were the team that sort of, you sort of fancy to actually get there, because as you mentioned there, Shane, have been on a fantastic run, but that Atalanta game was maybe just sort of a step too far for them. So, yeah, it's a very difficult one to call, but, yeah, just to point out, it's head-to-head rather than goal difference that will decide fourth spot should two or more teams be level on points at the end of the season.
Similar issues or race on in the Bundesliga. And I just looking at another story, Hamburg have been promoted and they look to be a pretty big side to go back into the Bundesliga.
Yeah, so I mean, this Hamburg was, you know, they got relegated 7 years ago, and it was the first time in their history they'd ever been relegated. They used to have a clock in their stadium that would have done the days, minutes, and seconds that they'd been a Bundesliga club, and they had to switch that off when they were relegated 7 years ago. I think most people in Germany and sort of, you know, European sort of football pundits expected Hamburg to bounce back straight away, and that this couldn't sort of be like a long stint down in the second division. And it turned into an absolute nightmare for them. I sort of put them in sort of similar to Leeds, really, where, you know, a really big club in a big city, a load of pressure that comes with that. And every year it just felt like that they were going to get back and then something would go wrong, usually towards the end of the season, and they blew it on a couple of occasions. There was a monumental outpouring of emotion when they finally got up at the weekend. You know, the whole pitch was just flooded following a pitch invasion from the supporters. It's great to have them back. I think the Bundesliga, the bottom half teams in the Bundesliga, There's a few small ones there, and I'm not sure that that does the league any sort of great wonders, really, because you had Hamburg and Schalke, another really big club that had found themselves in the second division. Somebody like Kaiserslautern even went further down than that. Now, they've all been terribly managed, and so you can't, you have to sort of, you know, I suppose, play the cards that you're dealt, and you know they deserve to be relegated. But I just think that the league will benefit from having somebody like Hamburg back in the top flight next season. Hopefully they can stay there. And yeah, it's really tight in the race for the top four. Dortmund were, I mean, I've just put my betting hat on for a moment. They were 25-1 to finish in the top four at the end of March. And they've now got themselves into a position where they should make it as long as they beat Holstein Kiel at the weekend. Yeah, so Kovac, since he's gone in charge, they've really motored up the Bundesliga. And what it does mean is the other two teams that are competing for the top four, Freiburg and Eintracht Frankfurt, they meet each other on the final day. So it's basically a Champions League playoff on the final day between those two teams, assuming that Dortmund get the victory that they need by a couple of goals against Holstein Kiel.
Okay, great stuff. Mark, before we let you go, who's going to win the playoff second leg this evening? Sunderland 2-1 up against Coventry. And I enjoy this. I don't know if you saw it. Sunderland have moved in their advertising hoardings, basically, because Coventry like taking long throws.
I mean, Sunderland have got a brilliant home record in the playoffs. Do you know what? I feel like Coventry are not out of this one yet. I might go for Coventry to cause a bit of an upset.
Okay, great stuff. That one is finally poised. What, 2-1? To Sunderland after the first leg. Okay, Mark Langdon, we're going to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on Game On.
Game On. Hurling.
We're turning our attention to hurling. Niall Moran joins us on the line now to look back on a cracking match in Munster and three contests in Leinster as well. Niall, let us begin our conversation with Tipperary's victory over Clare. And again, I am always posing broader questions to you as opposed to just match specific action. What will this win do for Tipperary hurling now in terms of belief this summer? Will this be the launch pad now to create an extended run?
I most definitely hope it would be. I suppose first and foremost, when they finished up last year, I think really the pride in their own jersey was probably questioned by a lot, and maybe even within their own dressing room, they might have questioned, really, do we give it what you'd expect out of a Tipperary jersey? And I suppose, obviously, the results will ultimately be the most pleasing thing to Liam Cahill on Saturday night, but it was definitely the manner in which they won it, and it wasn't the going 12 points up with four goals in the first half. It was more so the last 10 minutes when, really, it looked like, okay, we've been given a head start, and we've been clawed back in, and we're going to fall apart. When you expect them to die and maybe Clare to go on and as all Ireland champions win and have a 3 or 4 point win, Tip just dug in, new leaders emerged. Like obviously John McGrath hit a couple of critical points there, one particular in the second half. Owen Connolly's contribution, Shawny Keneally's contribution, and like I suppose, look, what is ultimately when you look at sports, I suppose, what is the measure of success? Is the measure of success sometimes that you're festooned with medals and you're festooned with individual honours, or is it sometime knowing that you emptied everything that you had in pursuit of, you know, I suppose, respect for your jersey, respect for your county, respect for your group? And I think ultimately for Tipperary, they had one of the biggest measures of success you can ever have as a player or a group, and it was just emptying yourselves out and maximising what your ability was, and with that, getting over the line. So I think for that group, there's very few wins that they'll ever have in their lifetime that'll be as satisfying. And I suppose I caution that it probably leaves them in a very vulnerable position next Sunday at home to Waterford. Do you know what I mean? I suppose, to be honest, in real time, as I was looking on the game as it was finishing out, I thought Waterford would actually be the team who might gain most from that result. But for Tipperary and Liam Cahill, look, it's everything that they deserved on that particular night. And they've put down a tough 2 years. And, like, do you know what I mean? The players played for the management, and the management have given everything to their players. And so that's what team sport is ultimately about.
We'll contrast that with Clare. Clare have the week off and then they're away to Limerick, which is not an easy way to finish a Munster Championship, but more likely than not, they won't come out of Munster. They're playing 1B in the league next year. Are we at a changing of the guard moment for Clare with a few players perhaps stepping away? Listen, I know Brian Owen can step away whenever he wants, considering his All-Ireland title, but perhaps broader picture for Clare, would you be concerned?
I suppose, like, you're not going to, Johnny, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, you suppose, like, yeah, do you know what I mean? Okay, results this year have not been as what you'd like or what you'd expect from All-Ireland champions. But, like, again, like, you have to put the asterisk here, the amount of players that they're down, and not just any players. We're talking, like, experienced players, central players. Like, do you know what I mean? It doesn't need for me to repeat all the names of those players. So, like, we've seen it with all the other teams. Like, when you're down the caliber of player that you're talking about, then you do go from a situation where you become very vulnerable, from All-Ireland champions to becoming very vulnerable. I suppose the worry for Clare was that, again, no different to maybe 3 years ago in the last John Conniff for the All-Ireland semi-final, they had nobody that was equipped to replace them. And I suppose, look, you'd always hope that your National League would, so it's give you the opportunity to have those players. And like last year's National League probably threw up an awful lot more players to them than what this year's did. And look, ultimately, they're undone by injuries. You cannot, but do you know what I mean? It's very hard to make the argument otherwise. And you have to remember here too, they were 12 points down against Cork, came back and drew a game from nowhere against, you know, probably one of the best teams in the country. And again, the last day in the first half, they were 12 points down, 9 down at half-time, and 63 minutes gone, they're back level. So, so, like, you could be sensationalist here and say that's the end of the Clare team and there'll be a mass exodus. But in reality, you know what I mean? Unless work pressures take them, I can really only think of maybe one, maybe two maximum of those players that will leave. And so I suppose, look, it comes down to it. They've had big success. They're in the Munster 20 final tomorrow. They won another minor 2 years ago. There's players in Clare, but maybe it's just going to take a couple of years whereby they're going to have to transition them in. So, and look, ultimately, is there anyone better equipped than Brian Owen to do that? No. And again, I tip my hat to him how gracious he was to Liam Cahill after the game and even his words after the game. Not an easy position to be in. And John, I suppose the one thing I really that shone out to me was just the respect between some of these managers. Like, they understand as much and all as you go to beat the opposition and you're taught to hate the opposition. I think ultimately the respect that these lads had for each other, I thought was kind of heartwarming, to be honest. Like, you know, and maybe not something that would have been symptomatic of the Clare Tipperary relationship of 20 years ago when those boys were players.
No, probably wasn't, but that's probably the reality of the pressure they're all under. Moving on to Leinster, Niall, Kilkenny were impressive against Offaly.
Well, Ruby, I thought there was only one story in Leinster. I thought Clare was the only story in Leinster there now.
In the Tailteann Cup?
You're disappointing me. No, the John McDonough, a huge win for Kildare and that, but we'll come to that later on. Kilkenny, again, look, I thought probably they played an Offaly team that are running on empty. Three or four of those Offaly guys have a full 120 campaign against them, and obviously they had disappointment during the week. They were knocked out of the championship by Dublin. I suppose, look, Kilkenny got a head start very, very quickly. TJ Reid, obviously, impressive. And look, I think maybe they might have written that one off as a bad day, to be honest. And again, for Kilkenny, Adrian Mullen back in the pitch, TJ Reid back in the pitch. They're slowly, slowly building momentum here. And I suppose if you were to ask me what is the one difference maybe about the Kilkenny challenge this year to the Kilkenny challenges of the last couple of years where they appeared in an All-Ireland final or they were barely beaten in the semi-final, I think it's the way they're swatting away Leicester oppositions. And I suppose the only questionable thing I personally would hold against Kilkenny was their consistency, not their ability to deliver displays capable of beating anyone. It's their consistency. And I think, you know, in the dark waters, they are displaying that consistency, which is all Derek Lynn can ask for. Obviously, bigger challenges await this week with Dublin on the horizon.
Dublin obviously were way too good for Antrim, but Dublin have been impressive so far this Leinster Championship.
Yeah, style of play, look, without going on, I haven't seen him firsthand yet. Again, the style of play that I can see resembles an awful lot of what Nafina had. And look, the confidence from a club that has won your county championship, winning an All-Ireland, it breeds confidence into the other players. And I suppose, obviously, with Neil Callaghan at the helm for Nafina, that in essence breeds confidence as well. So look, they're in a very, very good position. Obviously, you would imagine they'll definitely be coming out of Leinster. And I think really that is... I was going to kind of tell you where maybe Kilkenny and Dublin are both at in the bigger scheme of things. I suppose maybe in terms of their All-Ireland credentials, we're definitely going to see it, but it's definitely a bigger challenge for Dublin. Keane O'Sullivan, excellent there. Rowan Hayes, excellent goal. John Heatherton, big full forward line. So, look, in a really good place, as we had said previously, very unlucky in the league, could have easily been into 1A. And I suppose, look, that is also the fragility of the league. Like, you know, that if you are down injuries or you don't get a little bit of luck, you can slip up or not go up or not go down. But look, the league is irrelevant now. Big game, obviously. Pity that Stanger's 3 o'clock between two major Munster Championship matches. It's just, do you know what I mean? Again, look, the scheduling has been touched on before. It could be a little bit better for the exposure of those two teams.
Yeah, we've had a few false dawns in Dublin hurling before, so hopefully they can put it up to Kilkenny this coming weekend. Justin Galway's victory over Wexford is Cathal Mannion. He's really kind of taken over the mantle from Joe Canning in terms of importance for Galway. Is he hurler of the year at the moment, most in-form hurler at the moment?
Yeah, most in form hurler of the year. Again, I could be sensationalist and say that if it was hurler of the year pick now, he'd be hurler of the year, etc., etc. Look, Cathal Mainly has always been a brilliant hurler. I know he's had a number of injuries in recent years. And also, again, I suppose, look, when you're kind of, when there's a void of leadership, some players who are, not that they weren't leaders, but that were maybe still to the fringes in years gone by, you assume that leadership. And look, he has the ability to carry that leadership there at the moment. The team needed it. And again, look, Micheál Donoghue, I suppose earlier on in the year, he was looking at trying to expose as many guys as possible to it. Ultimately, he's returned to his tried and tested. Cathal Mainly has taken up that mantle for him. David Burke is back in situ at midfield. An incredible achievement for a guy at this stage of his career and still contributing. Again, look, maybe the only concern I'd have for Galway was that, I suppose, in terms of the spread of scoring, like, you know, it is heavily weighted in the direction of one man. And, like, even the last day, okay, Brian Kilcannon got a couple of points, John Fleming, everyone got 2 points. But ultimately, the really good teams, to get to that 30-point mark easily, you definitely need at least four guys contributing 3 points in play. And then, obviously, you'll get a goal, hopefully, and a few frees thrown into it. So, look, Cathal Mainly definitely carrying the weight of expectation for his county, but he'll need a lot more help as they go forward.
Now, if this was KFM, we would be talking about the Joe McDonagh, but unfortunately it's 2FM, so we're going to concentrate on what will be the game of the weekend next weekend. Limerick and Cork, are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, the Rebels are ready. I happen to be down there at a communion there, and they were playing scant disregard to Tipperary and Clare, and they said they're only fighting out for the placing. So, look, we'll have the gates open. They don't have to come through the toll, luckily enough, so... We'll have the gates open for a start. Okay, we'll empty them out of the pubs quick enough there before they get too vocal. And it's really exciting. It's really exciting. It's a really exciting weekend, to be honest. Like, even obviously it starts at 2 o'clock, Tip Waterford. But for Limerick and Cork, I think the Rebels are really going to be chasing this. I think they really want to lay down another marker. For Limerick, the argument to be made that they'll want to put to bed maybe, obviously, there's two losses last year. In reality, Ruby, without trying to quench the enthusiasm, I don't think it's to be all and end all. I still see both of these teams coming. I personally feel, from a Limerick point of view, that if you weren't to win on Sunday, it won't make or break you. I think the feeling here is there's a day maybe to deliver the killer punch, and so the idea is still be in the fight when that round comes, and that might be the day we'd be hoping to deliver the killer punch. But look, it's just savage. Like, you know, there's going to be 50,000 people inside in Limerick. I'd imagine if Tipperary get up to go to the match in Waterford, you could have 35,000-40,000 people in Thurles, and it's just a brilliant place to be. Hurling is in a really good place, and it's really exciting for people there over the next couple of weeks.
Great stuff. Niall Moran, we're going to leave the conversation there. We're chatting hurling more tomorrow with Damien Lawler, and we'll be previewing all of the weekend's action on Friday's Game On as well. And massive credit to Laois, Westmeath and Kildare for their wins, and Joe McDonagh. A big win for Kildare in the Tailteann Cup. We're going to be speaking Tailteann Cup with Nigel Dunn after the break. Stick with us here on Game On 2FM.
Game On. Gaelic football.
Welcome back to Game On. We're going to turn our attention to the Tailteann Cup. Last weekend, of course, was the first weekend of the 16-team competition, and Nigel Dunn, the former Offaly player, joins us on the line. Nigel, how are you?
How are you keeping, lads? How's things?
We're great. Not a bother on us. Nigel, were you happy with Offaly at the weekend? 2-13-11 point winners over Wicklow.
Look, I was happy with the win, of course, because this time 12 months ago we started in I suppose humiliating fashion with a defeat to London, and that's not because it was London, it was the manner in which we threw in the towel and players all over the shop down tools. So from that respect, starting this year's Tailteann Cup with an 8-point victory, it was very unconvincing in truth, but it was a really good win, and at this stage it is all about winning. So yeah, from that point of view, really happy.
Of course, they are away to Waterford next weekend. Kildare were big winners over Leitrim, 36 points to 11 in Newbridge. They were impressive, but probably Leitrim were more unimpressive.
Yeah, look, it's a tale of two wars, really. In Kildare, like, you have the favourites for the Tailteann Cup, and it was a real statement of intent, 36 points. Alex Byrne was excellent, and he is an excellent player in general. He lights up a lot of games, and you've seen him with Nace. That brilliant solo run goal against Coola. He has that magic. He scored 12 points at the weekend. Kildare are the front runners for to put their best foot forward in this game. But you would have to ask about Leitrim and the inconsistencies. Like, they were really poor at times during the league. They famously or infamously gave a walkover, which is unprecedented in Gaelic football. But then they put up a brilliant showing against Mayo. Really structured defence. Really, Mayo struggled for long periods. And then to come out here against Kildare and and it was all one-way traffic from minute one. So it's hard to get a read on Leitrim, but Kildare are definitely taking this tournament seriously, as they should, because their main objective is, yes, to win silverware, but realistically, they want to play in Sam Maguire in 2026.
Looking at a lot of the results, there's a lot that are quite one-sided. Are we going to see buy-in, for the most part, from players and indeed fans for the Tailteann Cup this year? Or are we only going to see it from a select few counties, perhaps, who might have realistic ambitions to win it? And we might then, going forward now, see there's going to be a bit of a lack of jeopardy as the Tailteann Cup kind of just eases into the competition, and we're going to see more one-sided results?
I always think that with one-sided results, and it's probably disingenuous of us to say that that teams aren't taking it seriously. I think what you're actually witnessing is there's probably even a gulf within the second tier. So if anything, there's probably a case for a third tier of Gaelic football where there's still competition for these teams, and we don't want to make it like go games where it's a medal for everyone, but we have to be realistic as well. Like you rightly said, there was a nice few trimmings handed out over the weekend, and there was 45 points average scored a game, but there was big margins in victory. And right, there's a trend in the home teams won most of the games. The one outlier and the outstanding results of the weekend was Carlow going up to Brewster Park and overturning Fermanagh. So that result in itself would suggest, look, there is still a little bit of magic to be had in this type of a competition. And it's just we need probably more teams doing what Carlow did and kind of upset the apple cart and get a win away from home against a highly fancy team. Like Fermanagh were favourites to top that group. Now they're going to be under pressure. If they don't pick up something next week in Pierce Park against Longford, they have to go to Wexford in the last game, and Wexford are a really, really good side. So that's, they were in a situation where they were red-hot favourites. They lose their first game unexpectedly, and now they're in a little bit of danger.
Would you, when you say a third tier, would you simply make it two A-team competitions, or would you put the 16 into a two-leg playoff? Eight go forward, eight drop out.
I possibly on the spot, I'd probably let everyone start and then drop off into it. Have it the way it is, and then you drop into the third tier, or call it the party or share or whatever you want to call it. And like I said, it's not because we want everyone to play in a final or everyone to be competitive. It's just the longer these intercounty teams can play into the summer, the more they're developing, especially if you're bringing up younger guys. Like, you don't want a team finishing in May or June and another team finishing at the end of July. Them extra 2 months of intercounty training is critical for when you're going back the following year. So you're always playing catch-up unless you're playing deep into the summer. And I think that's the real benefit of having a third tier, is that they're training at a high level 3 and 4 times a week for the extra 6-7 weeks.
So you'd look at it as in the overall health of the sport would benefit from the third tier?
Absolutely. I just don't see how the gaps will be made up. There's a couple of different ways to make up the gaps between the top and the bottom. One of them is sustained periods of high quality training. And I do agree that at some stage you have to play against teams of a higher quality to know where you're at. So I'd be fluid with the Tailteann Cup, and we call it the Body O'Shea Cup, the third year. I'd be fluid with the integration of them too. And we'd be all the while trying to look to get the Londons, the Waterfords, the Wicklows, to get them to be able to, Not with the flick of a switch, but fairly fluidly be able to jump up to the Tailteann Cup.
Be very interesting. One, Westmeath, of course, were runaway winners over Antrim. When you look at the Tailteann Cup, what 4 or 5 teams do you see it coming down to?
Look, I've been quoted this already. I don't think you'll see a winner outside Kildare, Westmeath, Offaly or Sligo. And look, Kildare are the front runners. Westmeath will be extremely hard stopped. Just for the point I was making earlier, they're playing at a higher level. Yes, they lost a lot of games in Division 2, but they were competitive in every single one of them. And in Luke Loughlin, they have a player in the form of his life. Like 1-17 in a game of Gaelic football is phenomenal. 5 2-pointers. And Killian O'Connor's scoring record is under serious jeopardy going forward with these 2-pointers. It's going to revolutionise scoring charts and what we deem as good returns. Alex Byrne, 12 points. Luke Loughlin, 1-17. Mikey Bambrick, who was brilliant for Carlow, 2-4. There's going to be really high-scoring individual feats from now on as well. So that, from that point of view, the spectator will enjoy it.
Yeah, Luke Loughlin, I think, didn't he lose a championship match and then he won a High Rocks the day after? An absolute freak of an athlete. And I mean that in the most complimentary way. You stepped away at the right time, Nigel.
Well, I did, because freak of athlete wouldn't be associated with me. Maybe just freak. When I read that about Luke, I was thinking, is that lad well in the head? I'd have 3 pizzas that night and just relax. That would be the last thing I'd be thinking. I was more of the purest mindset rather than the athletic. But Luke, he's an incredible athlete, and I'm delighted for him on his personal journey and what he's went through and everything. It's actually quite inspiring to kids around the country, and his form. He was brilliant against Kildare in the Leinster Championship. I watched the game back this morning in Antrim and Westmeath. He was absolutely brilliant. He was brilliant. And 3 or 4 of his scores realistically could have been goals. He just hand-passed them over. It was frightening to see the form Luke's in at the moment. And that really bodes well for Westmeath, given a serious assault to try and win what will be their second Tailteann Cup.
Yeah, perfect platform for Westmeath. We're going to leave the conversation there. Nigel Dunn, thank you so much for joining us. We're taking a short ad break. Then we're crossing live to Quail Hollow. Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson are going to preview the US PGA Championship for us.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Now, world number one Scotty Scheffler has just won a tournament by 8 shots. Bryson DeChambeau is back in the winner's circle on LIV Golf. Rory McIlroy has finally completed the career Grand Slam. There are narratives around every corner at the US PGA Championship, the next major of the season, which gets underway at Quail Hollow on Thursday. I'm delighted to say Doug Ferguson is alongside our own Greg Allen to give us an exclusive preview live in North Carolina, Greg.
Yeah, and we've just had one of the largest bangs of thunder directly, it seemed, over the press centre that I've heard ever. They do get those type of thunder bangs here that we might not get so much in Ireland. But that's just an indicator that we've got suspension of practice at the moment because of this, what was a torrential shower, and torrential, really. You could hear it hopping off the roof of the press tent. And then came that thunder bolt. And obviously, from that point of view, we have no play on the course right now. And it's comes after a day yesterday of torrential rain on the course, so these practice days have been disrupted, to say the least. But the weather is supposed to ease out as the week goes on, and fingers crossed we will have a undisrupted 4 days of competition. And as you say, also the stories, the narratives, there's so many of them, but the biggest of them all, obviously, is can Rory McIlroy back up his Masters victory with a 6th major championship victory, because this is a course in which he has won 4 times, going back, incidentally, 15 years, almost to the week when he won the Quail Hollow Championship as a very young player, just turned 21, and he holed a putt of around 45 feet in the final green for an exclamation mark victory, with his tousled hair and his slightly bedraggled look by comparison to the very tight and neat haircut that he has these days. And McIlroy, 15 years on, is something of a veteran, but a veteran in fine form. And he is he's not actually the favourite in the Las Vegas bookmakers. Apparently, Scotty Scheffler is still edging it. Doug Ferguson, this is a story which obviously would be extraordinary if Rory was to back it up, having gone 10 years without winning a major. But where do you see the big storylines this week?
It starts with, it's hard. It starts with like Grand Slams, doesn't it? I mean, we were thinking about when Rory won the Masters that, well, all right, now Jordan's the one who would be the next best chance to do it. Well, then you thought, wait a minute, now if Rory, as well as he's playing, can he do a calendar Grand Slam, which is something that rarely gets talked about? I think he would be the 5th since 1960, if I've done my math right. Arnold, Jack, Tiger, Jordan in 2015, when he kind of fluked his way a little bit into that U.S. Open and then went over to St. Andrews. But boy, you start finding yourself looking so far ahead. You know, he's got the green jacket, he's got the Grand Slam, and all of a sudden, can he get the next leg? And then you start thinking about Oakmont, which is a brawny golf course, and then you start thinking about that little course for the Open, Port Rush, that he knows fairly well and has a score to settle, I might add, as well. I think it really starts with Rory, and I think it's probably proper that Scotty is still the betting favorite in Vegas, just because he's Scotty and he just hits the ball so well, and really is, you know, when you think about the time he missed with the ravioli injury, never thought I'd say those words. It feels like he's finally caught up and is kind of in early season form, even though we're in May. I mean, 8-shot wins is big stuff in golf these days.
Yeah, so Scotty Scheffler probably wouldn't be this marginal favorite if it wasn't for the fact that since Rory McIlroy's victory in the Masters, Scotty Scheffler ran away with the CJ Cup by 8 strokes and completely dominated from, you know, the first round, and it did look like the Scotty Scheffler of 2024. But look, you know, this other narrative regarding Rory, and we'll talk about Jordan in a moment, Rory McIlroy has had this major burden lifted off him. 10 years waiting to win a major since his previous victory in a major in 2014. Does it work necessarily to his advantage that burden is lifted? Or, you know, is there something, you know, good to be said about having that edge that he has had for the last 10 years coming into every single major? And, you know, the burden being lifted, the edge being somewhat not what it was, is this a double-edged sword, this burden being lifted?
I think it is. I think it's one of the mysteries this week. I think players were talking about the freedom that he'll play with now, having accomplished his dream of not only the Masters but the Grand Slam, and now he'll play with freedom in his swing, freedom in his game, etc. But there's also the floating on air, and I don't want to say not caring as much. I think you said it well, Greg. Do you have that edge and determination because you've achieved what you've always wanted to achieve? And I think we'll find that out not so much this week, but over the next 3 months.
The other thing about Rory's coming into this week is that, you know, he has played in the Zurich Classic in that very friendly four-ball event on the PGA Tour, which is not, you know, terribly serious. He did play last week in the Truist Championship, where he looked like he was just cooking nicely, but he never really got into contention, never really got those vibes going. Is this almost a little bit early? Maybe it's the US Open where he might kind of rekindle that real sharpness that he needs and focus, because it is only 5 weeks since the Masters.
It is, but I think last week was important, and I never thought we would ever in golf say that you treated a $20 million event as just warm-up, but I really think that's what it was. I mean, from the time he took to exhale, to decompress, and that was a great week with Shane just to hang, if nothing else. Last week, I think, was needed to get back to golf, and didn't look particularly crisp necessarily, but I think he got enough done to move his way into it. I think we'll see at Oakmont, but I thought last week was great for him to be able to play, and now it's game on again. I can't believe I just said that, but anyway.
Yeah, well, game on and game on, so that's all right. Shane Lowry, how is he perceived now in America? Because he's getting close many weeks on the PGA Tour. He's, you know, in his late 30s now, but he seems to have elevated himself into the world's top 10. Is he a major player? Is he someone who could contend this week? He contended last year.
He's a major champion, for sure, and so that makes him a major player. I think he's very, very well liked, just because he's such he comes across as such a regular who is full of emotion and full of game and fun to watch. He's not regarded probably at a level of, say, a Shoffley or Kepka, the ones with multiple majors, but I think he's viewed as being very capable. And yeah, you look at his form and the chances, and he's someone to be considered strongly, I think.
So looking at all these other storylines, Jordan Spieth is one major championship, as you've been saying, away from completing the career Grand Slam. And he's now talking about playing with the wrist injury and finally, you know, being able to reestablish something of what he used to be. But what he used to be was thoroughly great. Like 10 years ago, he could have won the calendar Grand Slam. It was pretty close. How close does Jordan Spieth get, do you think, to having a chance this week? He hasn't won for nearly 3 years.
It doesn't feel like he has a chance, even though he's capable. He got a lot of attention with that 62 on the final day in Dallas at the Byron Nelson, because that reminds people of how much this guy can really light it up. I found what was interesting, Greg, were the Vegas bookies have Rory at 80-1 to win the Grand Slam this year, and Jordan at 40-1 to win the career Grand Slam at the PGA. Some of that is the buzz coming off Rory, but the fact that Jordan hasn't won in 3 years is an attention getter. And worse than that, you know, you could mention Shane, for example, having I don't think he's won since Wentworth, if I'm not mistaken, outside of the team.
That's correct, yeah.
But Shane's given himself some chances, hasn't he? And I can't think of the last time Jordan came down to the final hour of a tournament feeling it and getting back those feelings again of winning. That's been a long time.
Actually, you mentioned Shane Lowry winning in Wentworth. It might be remembered that, like, over here you hear this narrative on television that he hasn't won on the PGA Tour, you know, since whenever. I mean, it's effectively 2019, because the Open Championship is a PGA Tour event, but he hasn't actually won on the PGA Tour since 2015 in terms of an event which has been staged in America, which was the World Golf Championship in Firestone. Now, having said that, when he won Wentworth, Shane, in September 22. He beat Rory McIlroy and John Rahm down the stretch. It's not like he's incapable of doing it. What does he need? What did you see last week in that final round with Straka that might have been missing and maybe he needs to work on?
It's seizing the moment, for lack of a better word. I mean, it was neck and neck with them down the straight. It was a matter of who was going to blink first. And I think, Shane, you felt like you needed to be a little bit more aggressive. I just got a sense watching it was not wanting something to go wrong instead of seizing. And I think that's what's going to push him over the edge. I don't consider the hasn't won an American soil thing. It's never held any water with me. I mean, Wentworth is a big tournament and a big field, and he's won against some, you know, same with Tommy Fleetwood when they say the same thing. I think it's ridiculous. But I think part of it, too, is weighs on their minds from time to time.
Okay, just briefly, in the last 30 seconds, we have Scotty Scheffler, we got Rory McIlroy, the two strong storylines, but Justin Thomas, of course, coming back, you know, having won recently, not having won since the PGA Championship in 2022. Which of these storylines is going to end up with the winner on Sunday?
I think it's Scheffler. I'm a little bit biased, having walked nine holes with him out here on Sunday. And he was, you know, what's the line here to his caddy? And he says, that little black box. And I couldn't see the black box. And the caddy said, just follow the ball. You'll find the box. He's hitting it really nicely.
Doug Ferguson, as ever, you go for Scotty Scheffler. I'm going to go for Rory McIlroy. Big surprise there. And again, he is playing on a course in which he's won four times, Shane. So I think I'm making that as a reasonably well-backed-up argument. But no surprises here. Doug's going for the Las Vegas favourite, Scotty Scheffler. I'm going for the second in the favourite rankings, Rory McIlroy.
That's fair. Greg Allen, Doug Ferguson, thank you both very much. Ruby, who are you going for? Are we going to have an Irish winner?
I hope so, and I think Rory will just keep rolling on.
Hopefully. Okay, great stuff. That is all we have time for. Big thanks to this evening's producer, John Farrell. Laura Lee Davis was a broadcast coordinator. Bette De Silva is up next with a new music show. We're going to take a short ad break and check in with the news desk. From myself and Ruby and all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.